It's a beautiful three-part harmony from the Beatles, Because is the name of that tune. We're talking with Carl Hoffman about his new book, Savage Harvest, an adventure story that sort of morphs into a murder mystery, and a grisly one at that. When we come back, we're going to pick up the story with Carl's own travels in this tale, because it was not travel for the timid by any means. It was a pretty tough journey, even 50 years after Michael Rockefeller's death and disappearance. Stay with us. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM. Carl, before the break, we were sort of talking about the almost spin doctor approach of the Dutch government. On one hand, they see Nelson Rockefeller's arrival as, hey, this is a great opportunity. We can put a good spin on this. We can prove to the world that we've moved beyond cannibalism. No cannibals here, no headhunters. Move along, nothing to see, folks, when in fact that was not the case.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the Dutch the Dutch are trying to maintain, sort of argue its case for retaining the western half of New Guinea in the United Nations right as Michael disappears. And when Nelson, the governor of New York, and this ex-presidential candidate sort of runs off to New Guinea, they see it as this incredible opportunity. I mean, and I have the documents that says, you know, now suddenly more attention is turned to New Guinea than we could have ever hoped for, and we should turn this to our advantage, and we should argue for basically, you know, their program and get Nelson as a supporter.
I can see why you described what happened to Michael. And as I mentioned before, at least one or two of the reviews said, oh, gosh, what's this guy making this stuff up? But you had a good basis for the specific steps that were taken during this act of cannibalism. I mean, it's not like you just pulled it out of your hat.
You're talking about that. The early chapters in which I describe his actual death right. And the consumption. No, that's not. We don't know for sure how. I mean, put it this way. There are no witnesses to his having actually been killed and consumed. But as the book demonstrates pretty clearly, I think, and all the documents show. You know, he was, I do believe very strongly that he made it to shore and was killed by the men from Ochnip. And if that happened, he was most certainly killed and consumed according to Azmat ritual. And that ritual is quite carefully described in anthropological journals. And, you know, it's not something that I made up. And the scene that I describe is how the Azmats would have done it, and that all, you know, they didn't vary from day to day or from death to death. The ceremony was always the same. In fact, in the origin stories, the story that we were talking about earlier, you know, they say very clearly that this is how it is to be done, and this is how it is to always be done.
Well, it's very powerful, and it's very grisly, and I can understand why the Rockefeller family might not want to admit. They prefer to thinking that that Michael just drowned or something, that rather than this happened to him. But you uncovered information, or at least indications, that Michael's mother, at least, tried to get to the bottom of things by hiring her own investigator.
Well, I don't know if that's true or not. Okay. There is an Australian private investigator who is a bit of a showman, and discreet would not be the word you'd use to describe him. It would seem to be the opposite of the kind of person that a Rockefeller would hire. He wrote a memoir in which he talks about supposedly being hired by Michael's mother after the death of Nelson, and what he describes it doesn't hold water, doesn't make sense. He describes the people who do things that Azmat don't do, and the topography and geography he describes is not the topography and geography of Azmat, and he describes the skulls hanging from beech poles, the Azmat totem poles, and the Azmat don't hang skulls from their beech poles. So I think it's he may have had some minor involvement, but I don't believe that what he describes in his book actually is a full fully took place.
We mentioned about how big of a story it was. I mean, it was global. It went all over the world, headlines all over the world, and it continued to be a big story, but it subsequently spun off into other things, as you note. I mean, songs are written about it, TV shows and articles, and in all sorts of ways it manifested itself, right?
Absolutely. And when people, I mean, as we've seen just with the disappearance of the Malaysian jetliner recently, I mean, or the mystery of Amelia Earhart, I mean, when people vanish and there's no trace of them, it's really disconcerting. And human beings, we don't like those mysteries. We want to know what happens, and those things tend to get lodged in our consciousness and kind of nag at us, and they don't go away.
Well, they certainly did in yours, and as a result, I mean, the journeys that you took are maybe not quite what Michael Rockefeller did, but pretty close. I mean, this is pretty tough travel. I mean, even 50 years later, there's not a, there's no landing strips and there's no cars, and it's still pretty tough travel, and you tracked it down.
Yeah, I mean, if you go and you Google Map, go into Google Maps as Matt, you'll see the little arrow for Agats. But at least as of a year ago, there were no street signs, and there's certainly the villages of Azmat aren't listed. It's just a big green blob. And I wasn't the first Westerner to go to Azmat, and the tourists go a few every year, but not very many. I mean, it's really off the beaten track. And when I went there, I ended up making 2 2-month journeys there, and it's a long kind of crazy story of trying to penetrate a place that is difficult to penetrate. And I had to get a translator and a guy with a boat, and they all had assistance. And I made this whole long series of journeys into throughout Azmat, but in particular Omadicep and Ochnep, the main villages that were involved. And ultimately, I got a lot of backstory. People did remember the Dutch raids. They remembered it quite vividly. And that's a fascinating story of when I first heard that tale. But ultimately, I got kind of stymied by people, especially by the village of Ochnep. I mean, it's like people don't want to talk about it.
Well, why not? Why not this far? I mean, you came pretty close to just basically confronting some of the folks you probably think have direct knowledge of it, and or their families or people that know a lot more than they're saying. Why would it still be something they'd worry about talking about?
Well, it's a fascinating question. I mean, it goes to the heart of a lot of things. I mean, on the one hand, at the very most basic level, I mean, they were cannibals and headhunters, or their fathers were, or their ancestors were 50 years ago when Michael Rockefeller was there. But they aren't anymore, and they're Catholic. Call themselves Catholics now, and they're sort of developed enough at this point, or I should say, there's enough technology, and the outside world is enough that they know that cannibalism and headhunting is about as transgressive as it gets, and not they I think they feel ashamed of it, and they don't. It's not something that they. It's not who they are now, and they don't want to talk about it. But at a much deeper level, I mean, they're from a world of where reciprocation and we would say revenge is everything, and where there's this active spirit world, and they're afraid to talk about it. They're afraid of reciprocation. They believe the Rockefeller family should come after them, and the American government, and the government of Indonesia, and the spirits. And I tracked down, I believe, a terrible cholera epidemic that hit the village a year after Michael was killed, and killed about 10% of the village, that they attribute that cholera epidemic to spiritual kind of reciprocation and revenge for their having killed Michael. So it's a hugely touchy subject, and when you drop into the village, you just appear out of nowhere, and you're some guy, and you're asking them these very deep questions. They don't want to answer.
Well, we'll come back to that. I'm going to go to our first-time caller line, Andrea in Tennessee. Good morning. You're on with Carl Hoffman.
Yeah, thanks. I wanted to let you know that I used to work in Massachusetts for a man who was a fellow trustee of a university in Washington, D.C., with Mrs. Rockefeller Nelson, the mother of Michael. And I was in my early 20s when I did this. I was his secretary. And he would travel to Washington for board meetings once a month, basically, and he would see her there, and he'd come back and sort of, he was kind of, you know, a little bit in awe that, you know, she was on the same board. And this is in about 1971, 1973. And I do remember him telling me that, because I grew up in New York, and Nelson Rockefeller was my governor for most of my life when I was, you know, as a kid. So, you know, and I lived in Westchester County, which is where the family lived in Tarrytown. So I certainly was interested in the Rockefellers. And anyway, my boss said that Mrs. Rockefeller had admitted, you know, that she knew that he had been killed and eaten. And I remember,
Oh.
yeah. And so she knew that. And I guess you said that that Mrs. Rockefeller conducted her own search, and I don't know when that would have been, you know. But anyway, during the early 1970s, she told my boss that this had happened to him, so she knew. And obviously, it was, there's not much more you can say, you know. So it was, you know, the family knew, and you know, I think they were sad about it, and there wasn't much you can do. So I'm just curious, is the Sepik River near where he was?
The Sepik River is on the other side of the island of New Guinea is divided into two countries, and the Sepik is in what's now Papua New Guinea. So
Okay.
it's a region of similar
Yeah, because
topography and culture, but not the same.
there was a lot of art. I also saw in the 19 early 1970s when I lived in Massachusetts, up at Salem, the Peabody Museum of Salem had the Sepik River art and the shields and things, as you described, with the salamanders on them. And the anthropologist from that museum lived over there. It was Carlton Gajdusek and Peter Fetchko, I think it was. And they were studying, they used to give programs on it.
Well, the Peabody actually has some beach poles from Azmat that
Okay.
Michael Rockefeller brought back as well.
Yeah, I haven't been there in a long time, but I used to live near there, so I remember knowing about that then.
Well, Andrea,
So,
good memory. I appreciate that the call, and I don't know if
yeah.
that helps Carl tie up some loose ends or not, but it seems to be at least partial confirmation.
Well, I think that one of the big questions is always what the Rockefeller family, in particular what Michael's family, knew or admitted personally versus what they have admitted publicly. I mean, even today, Mary, his twin sister, you will not publicly accept the idea that anything happened to him beyond drowning. But you know, Milt Macklin reports in his book in 1972 describes writing to the Rockefeller family and informing them of his findings and you know, receiving nothing back, just a boilerplate letter, you know, thanks so much. I mean, I'm not sure what I believe of this story of Michael's mother hiring somebody. She may have hired this guy. I don't think he did what he said he did. I think it's hard for me to imagine the family not believing that he had been killed, but you know, who knows?
She mentioned about the art, seeing the art, and you get into that a little bit. That the legacy sort of the story is that this art is incredibly valuable, and people can still see it.
Yeah, it's really remarkable. I mean, there is the Michael C. Rockefeller wing of the Metropolitan Museum of Art in Manhattan in New York City, and that contains a number of beach poles and a canoe and shields and paddles and on display. And he brought back ultimately, or I should say the family brought back, he collected about 500 objects, and some of that is on display at the Met, and it's really spectacular, and especially after reading the book, because some of those, to go look at it and understand its provenance and its story is really, you know, you're kind of in, I mean, I'm in awe every time I go in there.
You know, we've talked about a lot of the details of the story in the book. What is difficult to convey in just a conversation over the radio is the context, the texture of this place that you paint it in such vivid details. I can almost smell it. I can almost see it. I mean, it's you have to read the book. It's not something you can just say over the air and people get it.
Yeah, and that's why it also took me. It's a unusual and a difficult place in a lot of ways, and that's why, and not just culturally, but just the geography, and that's why you know, after I made the first 2 month journey, and I'd gotten a little bit of information and sort of the story of LePray, and but not much on Michael, and I went home after 2 months and I started working on the book. But somewhere along there, after a couple of months, I just put my pen down and I realized that I didn't understand the place. I didn't understand the Azmat at all, and that I needed to go much, much deeper, and that even though I'd been there 2 months, I'd been traveling a lot. Logistics are difficult. I'd spent days just trying to move around. I had all of these people with me, translators and cooks and everything, and I decided I really needed to go live in the village, and that only through living in the village and learning, I learned to speak the Indonesian language, which they speak now, and that only by doing that and going in there alone with no translators, no guides, would I be able to personally sort of experience the place and the culture enough in order to not only to describe it, but to understand and to know for certain if what was in these reports about Michael had actually happened.
And did it work?
Yeah, it was really incredible. You know, I mean, there are these two photos that I have that I'd like to show. You know, when I my second journey to the village on my first trip to Azmat, you know, after 4 days being there, people stopped coming around. I couldn't get any more information. No one would talk to me. And I left. I took a photo of the men standing on the banks of the river as I left. And they're all standing there with their arms crossed. And they look, you know, they're the most inscrutable faces you've ever seen. There's nothing friendly or warm or welcoming about them. You know, my hair sort of stood up when I was in the village. But when I went back this time, 7 months later, and I could speak the language, and I found this elder named Kokai, who I'd met before, who had been the Kapala Desa, the headman of the village, a few years earlier, and I asked him if I could live with him and stay at his house, and he said sure, and I did, and that changed everything.
We'll pick up the story on the other side. Dire Straits, so far away. Take us into the break, and we'll go back to the phone lines as well. Carl Hoffman is my guest. Savage Harvest is the book, and it's a must read. Good stuff. We'll be right back with more Coast to Coast AM. You too still haven't found what I'm looking for from 1987's Joshua Tree, an appropriate sentiment at this stage of tonight's tale. Carl Hoffman, author of Savage Harvest, has found much of what he's looking for. There are a few loose ends still to tie up and a couple of questions from our listeners who are on the phone lines. We'll get to both right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Carl, I want to finish one thought before we go back to the phone lines. You were telling us about living with the Azmat in these two-month-long journeys, and I know from the book, gosh, these are pretty tough conditions. It's not like you're staying at a nice hotel or something. I just think about the plumbing system that you describe. I mean, you gave all.
Well, there is no plumbing in
yeah.
In the village of Ochinep, at any rate, and No plumbing, no electricity, no power, no internet, nothing of any sort. And there's most of the houses are just made of palms, and there's a little privy out back that sort of drops into the swampland below, and there's no furniture in the houses. And you wake up, the house I stayed in, there were about 20 people living, and everybody, no beds, no furniture, no chairs, no pictures on the wall. People really don't have much. There's just a little kitchen out back, which is a fire and a pile of mud that's sort of the base on the wooden floor, and coals burning, and that's it. And you eat the sago, just the heart of this palm, and little fish and these little shrimp and some sago worms, like the larva
Oh,
of a
okay.
beetle.
All right, I got it. But you were there on a mission. I mean, you wanted to have somebody face to face tell you what was going on, and you came so tantalizingly close. It seems like in the book. I mean, you had at one point where you thought you were going to be able to pay some money and get the glasses.
Yeah, the glasses are sort of the holy grail of the Michael Rockefeller story, because there's so many bones and skeletons around Asmat, and someone could give them to you, and what would you do with them? You'd have to do some DNA analysis with the cooperation of the Rockefellers. I mean, that's just a crazy sort of maze in which there's no return. The glasses, he had very distinct glasses, and there aren't a lot of eyeglasses in Asmat, and so the idea of getting those has always been tantalizing to people. I got kind of led down a wild goose chase, and ultimately didn't get them, and I don't believe they're there, and I don't believe any parts of his body are there any longer. I believe they're long, long gone. But there were things that I wanted to know there that were, I had all these documents and the descriptions, the reports from Van Kessel and Van Pi,
The names. You had the names.
and the names of these people who had been killed. But I really wanted, the more I understood Asmat, that was really the key to sort of deciphering what the documents said. And ultimately, what I re there were some very specific things that I wanted to find out, and that was who had Max Lepre, the Dutch patrol officer, actually killed when he'd opened fire in the village. And it turned out there were five longhouses, men's houses. Each men's house sort of corresponded to a clan, and the head of the men's house was the most important man in the village. And there were five of those men's houses, the five sort of head of the clans, and Lepre had killed four out of five of those, four of the most important men in the village. And then and that was confirmed to me. And then ultimately, I wanted to know how the men named in the reports as having actually killed and consumed Michael and taken body parts were related to the men killed by Max Lepre. And it turned out they were related by blood and had taken over the leadership positions of those men's houses, those longhouses, and they had those positions carried a sacred obligation to reciprocate the deaths that Lepre had caused. And that made me feel very, very certain of really what happened.
Wow, let's go to the phones. Jeff in Culver City, a question for Carl Hoffman.
Yes, hi, George and Mr. Hoffman. Yes, I'd just like to know if there was any spiritual transference entering these headhunters whenever they would cannibalize their captives or enemies. It's been said that when one human eats another, the individual captures the essence or personality of the one eaten. And if this is done on a regular basis, that would mean that the souls of many people would be inside these various headhunters. Do you know of any villagers who had done this and had multiple personalities because of this type of activity? And I'll take your answer off the air.
Thanks, Jeff.
Well, the essence of your question is correct, and that is the fundamental. I mean, what's going on when people at the root of cannibalism is really taking the powers of somebody else, and in Azmat term, the Azmats actually would become take the name of the man who they killed and who they consumed. One person would, you know, if I killed George, I would become George, and George's family would even call me George. And
I don't recommend that, by the way.
Beg your pardon?
I don't recommend it. I'm sorry to interrupt.
Yeah, and that is the essence of Azmat cannibalism, or as it used to be carried out. And the idea of multiple personalities, I've never heard anything about that. You know, if anything, it made the warriors felt stronger and more powerful.
Yeah, Jeff, thank you. That's an interesting place to take that question, but the book goes into a lot of detail about what the Azmat believed when they consumed somebody. It's fascinating stuff. John in Illinois on East of the Rockies line. Hi, John. You're on with Carl Hoffman.
Good morning, gentlemen. Carl, I'd like to know, besides Mr. Rockefeller being consumed, if you'd looked into the possibility that his head had possibly been transformed into a sensei or shrunken, and is it in someone's collection somewhere? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Thanks.
Yeah, the Azmat did not shrink heads. That was done, I suppose, in the Amazon and other places, but not in, there's no record of it in New Guinea at all. The Azmat had a pretty specific ritual that they carried out with the skulls of people who had been killed, as well as with skulls of ancestors. You don't see many of those skulls around anymore. It's my belief that Michael's head ultimately was something. I mean, after the killing, there was this huge search and rescue and a lot of fear, and, you know, it unleashed more helicopters and steel vessels and airplanes and soldiers than Azmat had ever seen before, and I think it was regarded as sort of a catastrophic event. And the Azmat, as the stories go, the skull was actually placed in a tree very far away in the jungle. And I believe they just left it there, and no one knows where it is anymore. That's my firm belief now.
At some point, they knew, man, this is a really serious thing. We got to keep this to ourselves and not talk about it outside the tribe.
That's correct. And that's very common, not just in Azmat, but within a lot of Pacific Melanesian cultures. There's a lot of secrets and things that, you know, some people can know and other people are not allowed to know, even within a village. And that's particularly true for outsiders. I mean, that I talk about that in the book, and as the book sort of ends with that, with the this idea, you know, the Azmat saying over and over again that they talk around the event and talk about all these events sort of that led to that surround the killing of Michael, but the actual and they'll even tell the story, but the some of the details they won't speak about, and yet they'll also will, you know, I've seen them, and I talk about it in the book as having secrets that they say, you know, these things are so sacred and so secret that if you tell anyone from outside of the village or anyone from outside of the men's house that they could die.
The rumor pops up that, of course, he didn't die at all, that he lived on, that maybe he just went native and went into the jungle and he was still there and people would get glimpses of him over the years, right?
I mean, you know, people have said any crazy things about everybody. I mean, that there's no truth.
Jesse James
that
is alive and Billy the Kid.
Yeah, sure. I mean, there's not only no logical reason that he would be alive or would not want to, you know, would have kept himself hidden, but, you know, the reality is that we have these documents and we have the stories from the Azmat, and I mean, the upshot of all my work was that, you know, I can never be absolutely 100% certain that this is what happened to him, but I feel like, you know, the book is incredibly well documented, it's all footnoted, and that everything in the documents and everything the Azmat say corroborates one another, and that it actually fits together quite well.
I agree with you. It's pretty powerful. First-time caller John in Florida. Good morning. You're on with Carl Hoffman, author of Savage Harvest.
Good morning, gentlemen. Thank you for taking my call. I'll just be real quick. I basically wanted to know, as far as you were speaking earlier about all the artifacts and stuff that they actually brought, that Mr. Rockefeller actually got over there. Is the website actually in the book that that the artifacts can be seen by guys like us?
Oh, absolutely. The Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York is open to the public, of course, and there's a whole room, a whole wing of the museum that's dedicated to Michael, and it has a large number of the objects that he brought back.
Right, but what I'm saying is there a website that I will be able to see these artifacts in your book?
Yeah, absolutely. If you just go to website of the
we have the link on the Coast to Coast website. There's carlhoffman.com, and then there's harpercollins.com, Savage Harvest. But we have both links on the Coast to Coast website if you want to check them out. And we also posted a story that had been done about the book that has some of the photos and includes pictures of Michael Rockefeller, and as well as, I think, some photos of tribesmen and the artwork.
So, thanks for taking my call.
Thanks, John. Appreciate it. Let's talk about the Azmat. You know, Carl, in the last couple of minutes we have left, you mentioned in the beginning how they had never seen metal before, and then, you know, they see fish hooks and axe heads and things of that sort that are amazing enough, and then they start seeing metal boats and then entire planes made out of metal flying overhead. They've come so far since then. I just wonder whether these guys, the encroachment is so thorough that these guys are doomed.
Well, it's a sad question. I mean, doom is a strong word. I mean, I think as a people, you know, they're not going anywhere. But that said, the culture certainly is becoming more and more affected by the West and by Indonesia. It's a part of Indonesia, and there's a large number of Indonesians, native Indonesians from other islands that are going into Papua. You know, Papua is the site of the largest gold mine on earth and the third largest copper mine. And there's a lot of natural resources development in Papua, and the Indonesian government is keen to develop it. And as more and more people move in, there's less and less room for traditional culture. And, you know, people like the Azmat are, on the one hand, they have this rich old culture. On the other hand, they're like any other human beings. They get excited by cell phones and automobiles and airplanes and education, and they want it too, as they as is their right. So development is kind of inevitable, I think, and that it is sad.
You know, I was reading the book, you mentioned about gold and copper resources, which I don't remember seeing in there, but as I'm reading it, thinking, you know, Captain Cook was there, the Japanese and the Dutch, and somehow these guys had thwarted all kinds of incursions. It occurred to me that that's because nobody had discovered oil there, but maybe they've just discovered oil by now, and that would be the end of it.
There's oil in other parts of New Guinea, what's known as the Bird's Head, if you sort of look at the map. But there isn't around Azmat, thankfully. I mean, they haven't discovered any yet, which isn't to say that nobody ever will. Who knows?
Try to get one more call in west of the Rockies, Sam in California. Hi, Sam. You're on with Carl Hoffman.
Good morning, George. There was a movie some years ago that was, I guess, loosely based on this story called Welcome to the Jungle. And it was about four kids who went to actually look for him because Mr. Rockefeller allegedly had survived this flight, and the headhunters had worshipped him as a kind of deity, a spirit deity. And I'm wondering if he has seen this movie, heard of it, and has an opinion one way or the other on it. And
thanks,
I'll
Sam.
Take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Thanks, Sam.
No, you know, it's funny. I thought I knew all of the literature around and the film around Michael, but that's one I haven't heard of. I'm going to look for it and watch it. I mean, I think the whole book is really about how he was killed and consumed by the hazmat, and you know, very quickly after his swim. And I don't believe that he, you know, any tales or it's wonderfully romantic to think about that he lived or hid in the jungle or was a revered deity, but that's just not true.
Well, it's. I think I read about that Welcome to the Jungle in one of the articles. I copied a couple of five or six articles that have been written about your book, and it is mentioned in one of those. And then there was an off-Broadway play as well that I think you mentioned in the book.
Yep, for sure.
And did you see that? Have you read the script?
I have not seen the play. I'd like to, though. There's novels that have been written, and you know, a lot of people have speculated on it over the years. It's just something. It's one of those stories that catches hold of us and fascinates, you know, not just me, but so many people.
Carl, you've been traveling the world for a lot of years, a lot of sort of hairy situations and tough assignments. I would think this would be a tough one to top.
For now, certainly I haven't, it's at the top. You know, the whole experience of being an asthmatic and especially living in that village, the way I did was, really, ultimately a pretty spectacular, experience. You know, it taught me a lot of things about human nature and myself, and how you can live, and you know, people can be very, very different but be similar, and yet also be very similar and have a hard time understanding each other. But at the end of the day, during my experience in the village, you know, I came to really appreciate the asthmat, and you know, we you know, Kokai called me his younger brother, and it was sad to leave.
Well, it's a really great piece of work. I know you don't do this kind of work for the sake of awards, but I'm sure you should be up for some. Is there a loose end or two that you'd still like to pursue if you could?
You know, there really isn't. I mean, I still would love to talk to Rockefellers and know what they've done, if anything, over the years, and what they think.
Well, good luck with that.
Thank you.
Hey, it's a terrific piece of work. I really enjoyed reading it, and I thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
All right, Carl Hoffman. The book is called Savage Harvest. Check it out if you get a chance, folks. Thanks also to our earlier guest, Richard Hoover, and to my friends and colleagues there at Coast to Coast, Nathan Staton, Gina Salvati, Dan Galani, our webmaster Tim Binal, and producer Chris Boros. I'm George Knapp. I'll be back next Sunday night. Good night, everyone.